big question mark is labor, right? One of the things that companies have struggled with is that, you know, they're sort of retaining their talent and maybe not doing layoffs, although they could in a different kind of economy, because it was so hard to get these workers in the first place.
You are listening to C-Suite Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.
Welcome to this episode of C-Suite Perspectives, a signature series by the Conference Board. C-Suite Perspectives are conversations that take an objective, nonpartisan look at a range of subjects that matter most to business leaders. I'm Steve Odlin from the Conference Board and the host of this series. And in today's conversation, we're going to discuss the future of office space and office culture. Here at the Conference Board, we've written a lot about the hybrid work environment post-COVID and what the future of the office space looks like. And recently, we've issued a report from our Economics Center on commercial real estate and what's happening in the office environment. And we're going to meld those two subjects together today. And joining me today are Robin Erickson, head of research for our Human Capital Center, and Aaron McLaughlin, senior economist in our Economics Center. Robin and Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Okay, so Aaron, the whole world's changing in the office environment. Nobody goes to the office anymore.
We're here.
So close all the offices, right?
No, absolutely not.
So what's happening?
Well, so it's very, very interesting. As I like to say, you know, our infrastructure and our built environment is really about our behavior. You know, it is about our behavior. So as we know, the pandemic happened. People became very comfortable working at home. Productivity, something that economists like to talk about a lot, remained high. However, you know, being at home all the time does not necessarily work. So I think, you know, and Robin will talk more about this, what we found is most companies that do office work are embracing hybrid work. And so we have people coming in the office a few days a week. Now, as a result of sort of offices being different and serving companies and employees differently, as leases roll up, and most commercial leases are 7 to 10 years, companies are looking to shrink their footprint, save on some of the operational costs of their rent, but they are still keeping offices. They're generally just smaller offices, and they're not necessarily saving that much money, because what we're seeing is a quote unquote flight to quality, which is what commercial real estate folks call it when people essentially trade up into a more sort of like trading up into a luxury car, right? So they want more bells and whistles, in part to bring people back and to make the office maybe a different experience than it was before.
Right. So instead of lots of cubicles and
right.
offices,
yes.
Because it's you know, a hybrid work
right.
environment, it's more of an open floor plan,
more, yeah,
collaborative
lots of
spaces. But that has to be redesigned.
It
and
has
rebuilt.
To be redesigned. Yes. And you know, my background is working for engineers and architects and in the commercial real estate industry. So, you know, that's very exciting from that perspective, but obviously there is a cost for employers to do that, you know, and a lot of that is sort of built in, it's built into the operational costs. But there's other reasons why, you know, we're seeing that drive to new office space. And I actually pulled some numbers. In Manhattan, we broke records with 192 leases signed last year that were over $100 per square foot. So although we're seeing higher vacancy rates, we're also still seeing sort of record-breaking, you know, quote-unquote luxury offices. So there's a couple of reasons besides maybe just a smaller space and bringing employees back that you might want a new office space. One is for sustainability reasons. You know, you are going to have to, if you're a company, look to counting up your carbon, counting your carbon footprint in new offices with sensors and sort of smarter infrastructure, better ventilation and heating and cooling systems, give the opportunity for workplaces to be more energy efficient. And then secondly is technology and the way that we work. So offices that are sort of more high tech, that have podcast studios and content video recording studios, that have conference rooms where you can do video chat meetings, Zoom with others that aren't in the office. You know, all of those things are also being redesigned into new offices.
And Robin, the reason for all of this bricks and mortar reorganization is because of the behavior that's being driven. So companies are changing, people are changing, and it's a whole new hybrid world. Talk about what you're seeing there.
So we are seeing that, as Aaron said, many employees still want to work remotely, at least some of the time, but not all of the time, as she said. And so we actually did some research and found that employees agree with their employers that it helps to return to the physical workplace for three key areas. One, building relationships. Two, driving collaboration. And three, maintaining culture.
Yeah, and so therefore, you know, you have to reorganize your work, right? I mean, you know, the times when people have to work as an individual contributor, or, you know, you have to write a presentation or a report or something, that's kind of has to be arranged to be done when people are at home. But then what happens at the office is completely different. It's all the collaboration, the innovation, the brainstorming sessions, and so therefore it drives different space needs.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, especially for new people who don't have a sense of the culture, who don't know their colleagues, and so being in the office with them is a great way to get to know them. But what we were just talking about, if you're gonna split your work up between the work that can best be done in the office and the creativity, the brainstorming, all of those that you mentioned, and the work that can best be done at home, it takes a lot of planning. And I think that's the biggest difference right now for organizations, is they haven't had to plan their work by location quite as much.
So Aaron, you've written about the CRE, the commercial real estate space, but this is actually affecting the residential real estate space too. So people, you know, particularly in the urban centers, mm-hmm. we're living in these tiny little, you know, closets of apartments.
Yes.
You can't work and live, in that tiny little space. So people are upsizing their personal space. Rents are going out of control, and there's a shortage of rents, of rental space as a result of all of this.
I mean, we've had a long-term housing shortage in the U.S., and especially in most, you know, larger cities that have big central office districts. And so there has been a lot of talk about converting obsolete offices into residential. That can work in some cases. I did a report on this, within the last couple of months. It can work for about 10% of buildings that are obsolete. For most office buildings, converting to residential is not necessarily cost efficient, just because there's so much that has to happen to the building, you know, because there isn't the kind of plumbing, the kind of natural light, the kind of egress and materials used in the building that you would find in a residential building. So the cost, you know, it would really have to be less than 50% of the value it was as an office building, and all of these other sort of financial measures to make it work.
And this is, you know, it's easier said than done.
It's often easier to start from scratch, essentially. It's like renovating anything. You have to have a good starting point. Otherwise, it's not financially feasible.
Well, and, you know, people say, well, why don't you just take that office building and make it an apartment building? And your point is, well, office buildings have a floor plan that has a central core with a couple of very large bathrooms. And residential space has multiple bathrooms, multiple bedrooms, kitchen, lots of kitchens.
You need lots of windows. Strangely enough, which is kind of cool, it works very well for office buildings built before 1940. But there's only so many cities. And we've all seen, you know, cool lofts or cool old pre-war office buildings or commercial buildings that become apartments and condos. So, you know, that's kind of already happened in a lot of cities, but your standard 1970s, 1980s big concrete office building is not going to easily become a residential
structure. Yeah, I don't know about those buildings built in the 70s. I don't know what they were thinking.
The end of the brutalistic period.
Yeah, it was brutal, is right. But you've got this big empty space. So you've got utilization in some of our city centers of commercial office space close to half. And so you say, well, why don't you just get the half in one building, half in another thing, just put it together. But these are long-term leases.
They're very long-term leases.
It's going to take, you know, a decade or more.
Exactly. So I think when we think about the time frame, you know, the pandemic obviously started in 2020. Most commercial leases are 7 to 10 years. And so we're really going to see a time period of sort of resizing of office space and office leases that will probably be clearer to us in 2030, which isn't that far off, frankly. You know, that's 6 years from now. And at that point, these vacancy rates, which are running about 20% in most U.S. cities, largely will have leveled out. And hopefully with the interest rates in the banks, we won't see a problem in the meantime. We can sort of, you know, they like the quote, extend and pretend. So hopefully time and hopefully lower interest rates will sort of help work out the kinks. But the other thing that will be really interesting in helping the vacancy rates come down from 20% is that our supply of new office buildings is at an all-time shortage, right? Because so many commercial developers and buildings did not start or commence building new offices in the last 2 or 3 years because of high interest rates and because of this unknown force of hybrid work. So the lack of pipeline that we're going to see in the next few years, and the fact that this is a 7 to 10 year rolling sort of, we have to find our new equilibrium, means, you know, this is a bit of a growing pain, or, you know, a resizing. But I do think that it will become a lot clearer and hopefully will sort of smooth itself out within the next few years.
Okay, so Robin, if this is going to take us, you know, Aaron's saying, you know, optimistically 6 years, it's probably more like 10. We got the next decade. We're going to rearrange all the city centers. We're going to rearrange and redo all the apartments. We're going to rearrange all of this commercial real estate. Can you guarantee these folks that the future of work will remain in this way and that we won't then have obsolescence 10 years from now?
I cannot.
Oh, Robin. We were counting on you.
I'd do anything for you, but I just wanted to bring you to talk about the future. I want to bring you back. So just think about this. Consulting firms started creating touchdown office spaces near centrally located airports in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. The traffic to get into the cities was too bad. And so there, you know, I live in Chicago, and out by O'Hare, there was any number of touchdown office spaces so that people could fly in, go to a meeting for the day, and fly out.
Is that going to continue?
I don't know if it will continue, but then there was the co-working sites, right, that brought together different organizations to work side by side, people from different organizations to work side by side, and that was 2005. So the other thing I want to mention, if you don't think it's too science fiction-y of me, is that Ernest Cline wrote a book in 2011 that was published called Ready Player One, and it was about a metaverse, a world where people could choose to live with VR goggles and haptic gloves, they could choose to live through their avatar in a different metaverse. That movie, that book became a movie in 2018, and they are now getting ready to release a version of that metaverse. Now, do I think that, you know, offices are immediately going to start setting up in the metaverse? No, because it's hard enough to take your laptop when you go, you know, switch locations. Can't imagine expecting people to bring VR goggles and haptic gloves and be sitting on the beach going, you know, moving their hands and just, you know, being in an office when they're not really there. But I think that we can't see everything that we're going to, that will happen in the future. And so I think we're going to be in for some fun.
So Aaron, Robin's telling us that everybody's going to work through avatars in a metaverse, and in 10 years, we won't need office buildings. Isn't that what you heard?
I heard a little bit of that, yes.
Not going to happen exactly
like that. I don't think it will
happen. She's not exactly promising that, but it does say that it's going to change again.
We're going to have continual changes, right?
Oh,
we're in the fourth or fifth industrial revolution. You know, I think one thing that's really interesting from an economic perspective when we think about this whole rapidly changing, frankly, workplace situation is that the big question mark is labor, right? One of the things that companies have struggled with and that we've heard over and over again from our conference board members is that, you know, they're sort of retaining their talent and maybe not doing layoffs, although they could in a different kind of economy, because it was so hard to get these workers in the first place. And we have a sort of
talking about the skill set shortage.
The skill set shortage and sort of the structural shortage. We have the great resignation. We have, you know, we still have unemployment below 4%. And so there's a lot of power there for employees, and there's a lot of desire for employers to create workplaces that employees feel comfortable in. So, you know, I really think it comes down to then, you know, are people comfortable coming in 2 or 3 days a week? Are people comfortable in 5 or 10 years putting on these goggles and you know, and doing sort of this metaverse thing? And I, you know, that's really the big question. It's a human question, which makes it really interesting. But that sort of labor importance and the importance of having your talented workforce in a shrinking labor force, you know, kind of situation is key.
We're talking about the future of work and workspaces. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
Businesses thrive on innovation, and the line between the possible and the impossible blurs. At the heart of this transformation lies a force, unseen yet omnipresent, generative AI, the key to unlocking a future filled with boundless potential. Leading through the AI transformation is a groundbreaking event hosted by the Conference Board. This event stands as a testament to our dedication to provide trusted insights for what's ahead. It's not just an event, it's a calling for those ready to navigate the complexities of the AI era. Tailored exclusively for C-suite members and their teams, this pivotal gathering is your opportunity to bridge the AI knowledge gap and to lead your organization through its digital metamorphosis and to chart a course for 2025 and beyond. Join us November 7th and 8th, 2024 in Brooklyn, New York. Embrace the leadership challenge at the Leading Through the AI Transformation event. This is your moment to shape the future. Visit conferenceboard.org to learn more.
Welcome back to C-Suite Perspectives. I'm your host, Steve Odlin from the Conference Board, and I'm joined today by Robin Erickson from the Conference Board's Human Capital Center and Aaron McLaughlin from our Economics Center. Okay, so I don't know about this avatar stuff and wearing of goggles and everything, Robin, but it, you know, even if the science fiction stuff doesn't happen, you know, these things tend to happen on the margin, it's undoubtable that the future of work will continue to evolve, right? You know, so what are some of the other changes you see coming down the road?
So we have definitely seen that employees are valuing flexibility. We did a survey last November where we asked employees what their most preferred benefit was that was not compensation related. And flexibility was their number one, before bonuses, before retirement benefits. And so I think that what happened during COVID was the idea of working from home was forced on so many people, and they had to get used to that new structure. Organizations had to step up in terms of, you know, those organizations that didn't already have laptops for their people and that sort of thing. But we're agile. And so, you know, people got used to the flexibility. And I think now that it is possible to work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week with our technology, I think that people do value that flexibility.
Yeah. If I recall, before the pandemic, there was a generational divide, and it was the baby boom generation that said, never will I want to work from home. I want to go to the office every day. I don't want to deal with all this technology stuff. After everybody went kicking and screaming into 100% virtual world, it came out and it flipped. And the baby boomers now want to all stay home and work, and it's the younger people who are missing the socialization in the office and so forth. So these generational things have you know, to work through the pipeline here as well, don't they, Robin?
Definitely. We just published a report on the boomers, and they do. They want full-time work, and they want the flexibility to work when they can. And we're also, you know, we've looked at Gen Z, and they want the ability to have some flexibility. They don't see the value in only being in the office, but they want there to be reasons to go into the office. There's nothing worse than going into an office and having your team not be in the office. So you're stuck listening to a Zoom call in a closet instead of, you know, being able to be together. So I go back to the point, it just takes a lot of planning. The best idea I heard was to treat the office, going into the office, like an offsite, and, you know, plan for what will happen during that time, have managers figure out what works best for their teams, and really do take advantage of the time that employees can be together.
Yeah, and so there's not only a generational differences, but you also found in your studies, Robin, gender differences.
That's correct. Women are more likely to value a hybrid working environment, and actually have to value remote work more. I think it has to do with all of their caregiving activities. It's easier for them to be able to manage their lives if they are close to home. We also find that women don't switch jobs as often as men, in part because they've found a job where the commute is okay, right? And so they're going to stay there more likely than they would be to take a job with a longer commute. We also found that some of the underrepresented minorities prefer not having to be in the office. And so I think it's important for organizations to ask their employees, you know, through anonymous employee engagement surveys, what works best for them, and then do what works best for them. I think it's going to be different for every organization.
So, Erin, given these generational and gender differences in the workforce, do you see that impacting commercial real estate in the workspaces differently, depending on whether you're in huge urban centers like Chicago, New York, mm-hmm. versus the suburban areas versus, you know, maybe the smaller cities?
I think it very much depends on what kind of work is being done in the office, right? So, you know, I think Robin's example of, you know, maybe the big consulting firms having offices by an airport, that makes sense because those consultants are types that are, you know, serving clients and are always on planes and are flying here and there. You know, I think back to my home city of Boston, where if you are a biotech company, you want to be in Kendall Square in Cambridge or as close to it as possible. If you are a defense contractor, you want to be in Arlington, Virginia, so you can be by the Pentagon. You know, those kinds of adjacencies are not going to go away. And that makes it the location advantage for a lot of industries. You know, if you want venture capital money, you're going to be in Silicon Valley still, you know? So I think some of those very specific adjacencies are going to be there. There's lots of reasons for them. But again, one of the main reasons is talent, is, you know, wanting to be in an innovation, you know, or innovative district like in Kendall Square in Cambridge, where you're by MIT and Harvard. And if you're, you know, just a medical practice and you own your own medical office building, you're going to want to be near the large community hospital. So, you know, it's sort of, that applies for so many businesses. And, you know, I think for some industries where there are still a lot of industries where people have to go to work almost every day. You know, I think back to the industry that I came from, you know, design and construction, you go to work almost every day because you're working with teams, you're on site, you're on construction sites. Same thing for manufacturing or light manufacturing. There are still lots and lots of industries where sort of the value of being in person is really, really key.
Yeah, you know, Robin, Erin's making a really good point. You know, we talk about the future of the workspace as it relates to offices, but that's just a slice mm-hmm. of work that gets done. It's really hard to build a building via Zoom or, you know, right. cut hair via a Zoom call. So there are the services, construction, the trades, you know, all of these things still, you know, it's hard to eat out at a restaurant on a Zoom call too. So you're going to have a phenomenal shift in some work and almost no shift in others. You talk about the impact of that.
Yes. Although I do have to tell you that during COVID, I did try to cut my hair over Zoom with advice. I had the scissors and I was getting advice over Zoom for how to cut. That was only once. Only once.
And after the emergency care.
Exactly. After that, I just decided my hair didn't need to be short anymore. Exactly. But getting back to your question, yes, I believe that there is a world in which that won't change. We all like to go out to eat. We, you know, the American culture, you know, until COVID had us eating out for many meals, had us going, you know, we were busy. We were out of our homes. So I don't believe that we're going to totally have a world in which that doesn't happen. But there's increasingly more things that can happen. You know, you can get your groceries delivered at home. You can get almost anything delivered at home, actually, that you might want to purchase. To your point, Steve, you know, I think there are things that, you know, we are going to have to be doing in person. And so then I think organizations need to be thinking about how they compensate individuals. And one of the things I've heard is that some organizations are paying the workers who are on site higher than the workers who are able to be remote. And so I think that that's a way that you can look at it. And frankly, you know, we probably haven't paid the folks working in the restaurant business enough in the past. And so perhaps it's time to be paying them higher wages.
Well, that's an interesting comment too. But going back to the office environment, you know, so if you think about 10 years from now, you know, when this kind of all plays through, what do you think the inside an office space will look like?
I think that there will be more collaboration spaces and fewer offices and cubicles. I think that there will be places for employees to hang out. Who knew that Starbucks would become, you know, the desired office for many people who enjoy that environment? So I think it will look different.
Yeah, it's interesting. So in urban planning and urban economics, there's a concept of the third place. So it's not your workplace and it's not your home. It's your third place. You know, and maybe 100 years ago, that was a tavern or, you know, a club of some sort. And then it became Starbucks. And I can envision where the workplace, you know, there really is no third place because you have your home and you have your workplace, which can become a third place. I think, you know, I envision it almost like a university with a student union, a library, you know, you think of all the spaces of a university, a library, a student union, a classroom. I think offices will have these more, you know, loungy kind of third spaces in order for that collaboration to happen.
It's fascinating because what you're saying essentially is that offices are going to look more casual and really more like residential areas,
right?
Living areas. And living areas are going to have to look more like offices because, you know, you can't put a bed in a bedroom or a bathroom in the background. You can't have the kids running around. You really do need something that looks professional, like an office space. So people are putting offices in their homes and they're putting homes in their offices.
They are. Yes. I read an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago on how luxury home builders are building essentially like conference rooms and offices for executives to have in their homes if they can squeeze them in.
Yeah. And so that they can, you know, they can work remotely. Mm-hmm. So what does this mean, Robin, in terms of recruiting and, you know, attracting new talent? What are going to be the requirements of the space? And, you know, we used to think about benefits as, you know, healthcare, of course, but benefits now are also benefits in the workplace. You know, it's whether it's food, whether it's entertainment, whether, you know, well, so what does all that look like?
Well, one thing is that, you know, 30 years ago, nobody thought that you could work side by side with somebody in another country, in another time zone. And we have been able, through technology, and through technology exactly like this, you're in New York, I'm in Chicago, we're doing this podcast together. And, you know, the technology is there. And so organizations that are having a hard time finding enough people in their organizations, which we know many are with this very tight labor market, they actually, if they can figure out how to have remote workers, they can have teams that are across the world. It is a little bit of a challenge in terms of time zones and who's going to get up early and who's going to get up late. And I think that, you know, a lot of teams are making that work. So the ability for organizations to have remote workers, I think, does help them fill one of their major needs, which is to find people.
And you and I have talked about the cultural impacts of that because, you know, it's really hard to, you know, to take a culture and create that common culture when everybody's remote. So that's where kind of stuff's going to get done, is remote. And then the culture and innovation and collaboration, all that is when you come
right
together.
And so, and I do recommend that organizations that are set up like that have times when they bring all of their employees together or bring teams together in person in some of these new offices that Aaron was describing, or some of these executives' homes with conference rooms. And I think that, you know, that would give the team members the chance to get to know each other, to do that creativity and that bonding that's so essential to high-performing teams.
Robin Erickson and Aaron McLaughlin, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
You've been listening to C-Suite Perspectives, a podcast by the Conference Board.